you, everybody, for being here this morning. Usually kind of loud. So my talk is going to be on emerging locality. So let's see, what is my setup? So I think that we would all here agree that the low dimensional classical geometry that we live in is something to be found only at low energy. And that there's a, as yet unknown fundamental, more fundamental theory, quantum gravity, that we are all looking for in different ways, where that will not be the case. So what I'm going to do today is focus on one aspect of our world, of what we understand as the low energy space-time, that is probably the most characteristic one, which is locality. So if you were in a world with no locality, no notion of neighborhoods, no notion of distances, of who is next to whom, you wouldn't think that you are in space. Being in 4, 5, 6, 3 dimension, we can debate. But having no locality whatsoever, you would not call it space. Right? So that's exactly what I'm going to focus on and try to understand what the world could be like when such things as space, locality did not exist. Now, I'm not going to do that in a conceptual level. I'm going to do it in a model. So I'm going to present you a model that has two phases. An early, high-energy phase, where there is no such thing as locality. However, it's still in a suitable way background-independent. And it has a low-energy phase where certain notions that you think of as belonging to the space we live in emerge. So the model I present, we call quantum gravity. You'll see why. It is basically a condensed matter model of aspects of emergent space. And unlike a lot of condensed matter models out there, it has properties that you can interpret as being background independent, and that is part of what makes it interesting. This is work that Tomasz Konopka and I have mostly done with a bunch of people. What I'm showing today is in this paper. So I'll show you a preview of the model, and then I'll go into the discussion and the presentation of it, but I think I want you to have in mind what exactly that I'm doing. So what I'm going to have, here is my model and the two phases. The high energy phase is going to be something that has no useful notion of locality. So, for example, if you're here, the rest of the world is one step away. There's permutation symmetry in this, and it's a relational model, so we'll see that in detail. And my system will undergo a phase transition as I lower the temperature or as I wait in time, in which aspects that you will recognize as space emerge. And what I plan to do in this talk, first I'll give you a motivation for why you should consider such a system and the questions that come with it. My motivation is a little bit long because I think that the questions that made us consider this system are interesting and maybe they can be discussed in another context. For example, Baylock was addressing some of the same questions. So I will have a reasonably long motivation. Then I'll define the system and show what it does. And then I'll try to discuss and motivate you why it's actually very interesting to consider these things, because there being more space is actually radically different than being quantum space in a way that has not actually been explored so far. And I have, this is fairly new, as you can see in the beginning, it's only a few months old, so the discussion is going to be a sample of the sort of questions that I hope you will have by the end of the talk. All right. So motivation. So the very first thing, of course, is something that I think just about everybody in the audience would like to know. It's a long-standing problem in quantum gravity, which is how does the type of classical geometry we know and love, nearly flat geometry that we live in, emerges as the low energy limit of your, my, somebody's theory of gravity. This is a long-standing challenge. It's a very difficult thing to do, to get aspects of nearly flat geometry from something that doesn't have it. Quantum dynamical triangulations has recently made a lot of progress in this direction, as Jan Ambion was explaining yesterday. but it's for sure still an open problem. The second long question, long subject that has motivated a lot of this work is questions of locality. And what I want to convey, and Balak was also discussing this, is that largely locality has been underutilized because it has not actually been considered. People skip over that question. So here, for example, you can see what one commonly does. So say that you have spin networks, and we think of it as combinatorial quantum geometry. And the question is, which states under which conditions would give rise to a classical geometry? So in your spin network, you have operators such as quantum area and volume operators, which are very interesting, but they're local statements. So it's a statement about the area and volume here and there. It doesn't tell you anything about how these edges connect to each other. So if you're looking at the neighborhood of one vertex, you can have a quantum geometry in that, but connecting to the rest of the world could really be anything. And while people have discussed the properties of these, and have discussed the properties of vertices in spin forms, there is no discussion or analysis of the connectivity of these objects. And you have to keep in mind that generically, these guys will be, there's no reason to think that they would give rise to something that is local. In any case, I don't know that anybody knows that. And what I want to argue is that locality is actually more of the elephant in the room than whether you have aspects of quantum three-dimensional geometry on an edge. So, for example, if you consider perturbing such an object by adding a very non-local edge, then you can see that if you say you have a state with n vertices, I have of the order of n squared ways to add one non-local edge. So the number of states that are non-local is generally much bigger than the number of states that is local. So considering states that are local, as one guy saying weave states we discussed here, is really some sort of fine-tuning. You pick certain states that have very specific properties. Your generic state, if you pick one out of a bag, won't have these properties, and I do not know of any way of selecting the local ones from the non-local ones. If you further consider the fact that you're supposed to have superposition of those, then what you have is a very non-trivial correspondence between what I think many of us understand intuitively as the connectivity of the graph and any sort of locality of what will emerge from that. At another level, that is specific to background independence, not necessarily to spin network systems, is, which again Borloff discussed earlier, is that if you consider what happens in a phase transition, and you transport it in the context of background independence, then you'll see that generically, micro-locality will not coincide with macro-locality. The argument, so Borloff gave very nice arguments for that. I have another one that is the one that I understood this from, so I'll present this. But it's simple. So consider any phase transition of any system that you know that is non-trivial, where you have a micro system and a macro system, and by phase transition what you mean at this simple level is that the degrees of freedom that you use to describe your macro world are different than the degrees of freedom in the macro world. So if you have a spin chain, here you have a bunch of spins that can be pointing in different directions. Macroscopically, you have spin waves. And the degrees of freedom, that is the state space that you use in each one of these cases, and the dynamics that apply on this, is different. Now, you won't normally have any questions about locality because you do this in the lab and you have the room that your spin chain lives in. But if you have no background, then the natural way to define locality is via the dynamics. For example, through this tensor product here, or the sum there. And then what you would see is that the locality here, ignoring the background, is totally different than the locality there. The dynamics have very different notions of what a neighborhood is in the two phases. So my point here is that if you have undergone a phase transition from the analogy in quantum gravity is what was there before classical spacetime to what is after classical spacetime, then just the fact that you will presumably have changed your fundamental degrees of freedom and the dynamics on them will mean that the localities on the two sides will not match. So just to say that this we explored here is a very short version of what happens. We've explored it in a more specific context using methods from quantum information theory to have an analog of a phase transition without a background. So you could check that out here. So there's a lot of other hints as well that there is something fundamentally non-local in quantum gravity, which, well, this is a short list of such things. Some of it we heard about yesterday. So locality, I want to emphasize, is underutilized. I think it's a very important thing that locality might not be fundamental in our fundamental theory. It's a very good hint we have, and we have not really looked at it very much, if at all. So more motivation. Well, this is looking at the field of quantum gravity from a bigger perspective than, say, what the LOOPS meeting has. There is a lot of different approaches. So, for example, two weeks ago, I was in a meeting on emergent spacetime and approaches to emergent approaches to quantum gravity. So, for example, there are condensed matter approaches such as Volovic's helium results that are very interesting that Bullock was discussing earlier, where we get things like Lorentz invariance in a fluid, and you can understand symmetries that we think of as space-time symmetries as emerging in a condensed matter system. More generally, there are good arguments why general relativity might be emergent that I'm not going to go into here, mostly having to do with thermodynamical features of GR that I hope most of you have heard about. So I think there's a good argument that general relativity might be just an emergent theory. But the places where that is examined or that is discussed seem to be confusing if you come from the traditional background independent background, as I do. And I think background independence is an important concept. What you are trying to do in general is to implement the basic understanding from general relativity, that is the dynamical nature of space-time geometry, in your quantum theory of gravity. So the question here is, well, if you look at these approaches, the condensed matter ones clearly have something like a superfluid again in a background that is being analyzed. So I don't actually know how the dynamical nature of space-time geometry is really to be implemented. The argument is that it's supposed not to matter, but it's not explicit, and I find it confusing. And 2 days ago, we had a discussion on the extent of background independence in string theory. So here, I think, at least I have a confusion of how to link the notion that GR might be emergent with background independence. If I look at what we normally do in, say, loop quantum gravity or spin foams, background independence is normally implemented by a superposition of quantum geometries. So all of these approaches claim to be background independent, and the way they do that is that they consider all possible geometries and the dynamics on that. Now, what I will want to do in this model is actually try to consider what background independence might mean, which is not implemented in this way. So I will actually have a fairly radical new suggestion of what you should consider as background independence, which I will demonstrate in my model and we can discuss. So I will claim that a theory is background independent if it has no fundamental geometric or gravity degrees of freedom. So it's background independent in a very straightforward way. If there is no background at all, if there is nothing like gravity at all, then I would think it's background independent enough. And so I'll show that, as I said, in a specific context that I will then call a background independent condensed matter system. no motivation. Matter versus geometry. So these have traditionally been split. So again, in loop quantum gravity, you think that quantum gravity had better work for pure gravity. Geometry then is added on top of that. However, that might not be so simple, and in my model, it would be important not to make that separation. But to start with here, what I want to say is that there have been new results recently on emerging matter, that is, how to get things like photons and fermions from more fundamental degrees of freedom. And what will be interesting for me is that these are very suitable for the background independent treatment I want to make. So, for example, I would encourage you to look at the stringnet model that one and collaborators have proposed, for example, in this paper. Because what they have there is gauge theory-like excitations and fermions by basically looking at an excitations on what is really a spin network. The spin network doesn't have anything to do with geometry, but it is a network with basic group representations. So it will not be surprising, as you'll see later, that I can connect the results to my background independent setup. Finally, but not, is probably the most important reason I'm considering this model, is that I would want to argue that if locality is not fundamental, then a great new world will open up where the observational effects of quantum gravity may be large scale, not constrained by the Planck scale. Now, for now, we'll just leave this as a provocative statement. No fundamental locality may imply large, very large scale observational consequences, but I'll show you how that works in my model rather than say something vague here. All right, my model now. First, the kinematics, my states. So I'll start with a complete graph of n vertices. Complete graph means that every vertex is connected to everybody else. I've put all possible edges. So if I have n vertices, the complete graph, basic combinatorics, will have n minus 1 over 2 edges. I'm considering n to be very, very, very large. So every edge carries a state space, is a quantum system. Every edge carries a state space that is labeled by two quantum numbers, j and m. So every edge has a j and m. The j can take two values, 0 and 1, and I'm going to have an interpretation for the 0 and 1s. If j is 0, then I will think of it as there being no edge or an off edge. And if j is 1, then it can have different colors. That's what the m is. And the m can be plus, minus, and 0, but if the j is 1. So the total state space of the system is the tensor product of all the one state spaces. There are no Hilbert spaces on the vertices. So on this fairly simple system, I will have kind of the usual operators. So j, the j operator on my jm state pulls out the j value, the m operator pulls out the m value, and then I have raising and lowering operators. So now the dynamics on this. Well, the dynamics is cooked up so that starting from a complete graph, I'm going to end up with a ground state which looks more like what you would think of as a geometry, a spatial geometry, things with extension. So this is a complete graph of 8 vertices, and this is a regular lattice of 8 vertices. So what I would like is to get to a ground state of this system that looks like this by using my dynamics. So I'll consider the following dynamics. I'll do it term by term. So the first term looks like this. What does this do? This minimizes when the... So this considers the number of edges that come out of a given vertices, and it has a minimum when the number of vertices is equal to V0. So this turns off edges and has a minimum, stops doing so when all vertices half degree V naught. Okay? So for example, if I put a parameter V naught equals 3 into my system here, what will produce is candidate ground states that look like this. Right? These are all configurations where I've turned off a lot of edges and every vertex has degree 3. Now that is not good enough because that has, seems to be a very one-dimensional thing and there can be a lot of fairly sick things. So I want to get better, more regular lattices than that. So already what you should see here is that I've got an extension. So in the original system, everything is one step away, while by minimizing this term, I get two states with extension and also notions of locality. So for example, if you're here, then this is your nearest neighbor, while this one is a faraway one, which doesn't happen here. Now, to get even better behavior on the lattices, I will consider the M values. The M values really have to do can I get the next slide? All right. The M values have to do with basically strings running through my lattice. So each one of the black edges is a J equals 1, so it can have the three possible values of M still on it, and the behavior of that will further change the lattice. That's the other two terms. So the second term looks like this. The first part of it, what it wants is what comes in should come out. So it does not like open strings. So here I've used black lines to denote M equals 0, and red lines for M being plus or minus 1. I picked a regular lattice just so that it's easier to see. So the plus or minus 1 is a red line, and this term does not like it when it stops. So it prefers closed strings. This term here would prefer to have all M's being 0, so it's like a tension term, would like to shrink all the loops. The final term, again looks like this. You can think of it as a kinetic energy. So what it does is that if you go into a part of the lattice that is an M vacuum, so all M's are 0, it can create an excitation, an M value excitation, a little loop here. Or if you already have a loop, it can make the loop fluctuate. It can go back and forth. So this term has, if you look here, L is the length of the minimal loops. So in this simple lattice that I've picked to illustrate, the minimal loops are have length 4, they're square. So if you write the coupling here in this way, then you'll see that there is a preferred loop length. So there will be a preferred value of L, which will give you, for which this combination will be larger than anybody else. And since this comes with a minus sign, this will be the one that is preferred. So this term will tell me something about how large the loops are. Now, these two terms, vertices and loops, we did not invent. The first one we did, this one we modified. And we modified it from a generalization of the string net condensation model of Levin and Wen to a dynamical lattice. So Levin and Wen is this model that I mentioned before to you of emergent matter, emergent, for example, fermions, U1 and photons from an underlying bosonic model. So what they found is that when you consider the tension and the kinetic energy terms that I had before, then when the tension is much bigger than the kinetic energy, then you're in a ground state that has basically all the M's are 0. It has almost no strings. While when the tension is less than the kinetic energy, then you have an interesting interplay here where the ground state is a superposition of many closed strings. So they call this string net condensed, and that's the picture of it. So you can think here of the lines. Here is the red strings I had before. And what you can show, which I'm not going to go into here, you can find it in this paper, and you can probably guess how that would work, is that these give you an emergent U1 gauge theory, so you have objects such as photons in here, and if you have energy to spare so that you can afford open strings, then you also get charged excitations. So, again, to summarize what my system does, it has three terms, and they come, it's very important that they, each one comes with their own coupling, and I will consider a specific regime of this system. So I will consider the regime where this coupling is much larger than all the other ones. So the first thing that will happen in order to save energy when I go towards a ground state is to erase lots of edges. And eventually, I get into the regime where I'm considering what C, D, and B are doing, and they have an interesting interplay with each other because this is a minus sign and this is not, so I can balance this off each other. And if I do it right, then what I get is the matter I described in the next slide and also regular aspects of the lattice. So the ground state are first results, indications, show that if you consider this particular regime, what you get is that this balance between the tension and the kinetic energy term controls both the loop size and the matter. So what do you get towards the ground state? First of all, you get a large average distance. By that I mean that you can just plainly the graph distance in the ground state becomes large, bigger than one. You have a small vertex degree, that is a parameter in your model, and you have loops of an average size, L star. Now that doesn't mean yet that you're regular. So for example, these are two possible configurations where V naught is small, well, 3 in this case, and L star is 4. And this is a cube, and I don't know if you can see that, this is one of these impossible shapes. If you put lots of this together, you wouldn't recognize it very much as a space, right? While this would be very nice. So what we have so far is that you do get the extension, you do get the average size, not necessarily regular. We are currently using some interesting methods from graph theory with Simone Severini. And, for example, if you consider further things such as maximizing the number of minimal loops, then you get further regularities. So for example, for V naught being 3 and L star being 6, the number of minimal loops is maximized by this lattice. I have to emphasize that here I'm making a bunch of approximations that are consistent with the coupling regime I'm considering. So once you're on the ground state, then you also get the when matter for free, right? Because you still have your M values here that can be, that can produce the string condensation as before. So this is an interesting feature of the model. You get what controls the loop size and makes your lattices regular also gives you matter. So you don't get one without the other. So I can make a summary of what the features are of the two phases of the model. So at high energy, what do you have? You have permutation symmetry, at least under the J values. So every node here is equivalent to every other node. There is no notion of locality in that you have no useful notion of a neighborhood. So if you pick one guy here and you go one step out to have the neighborhood, you have the entire universe. The system is relational, of course, it's a graph. The average distance between any two nodes, two vertices that you pick is 1. For a very large number of nodes, you could think of this as an infinite-dimensional system or an infinite-dimensional lattice. I'm not actually making a very specific, not giving a specific recipe on how to interpret a lattice as a space, but if you were doing the rather naive thing of just reading off a space out of a lattice, you would think that this is infinite-dimensional. An interesting thing is that by having no locality in the way that this complete graph does, it also has no useful notion of subsystems. Again, if you cut a part of this, you end up cutting off the whole world. So it's very hard to excise a subgraph of, well, it's impossible. You cannot excise a subgraph of this graph. So it has no subsystems. It has external time. So for those of you that think background independence means that you should be timeless, we have to argue. This system has a Hamiltonian and hence an external time. And it also has micromatter. By micromatter, I mean the J and the M values on the edges. The low temperature state. Well, it has translations. So translations emerge. If you are further in a regular state, translation invariance emerges. It's local, clearly. You can consider a subgraph of this system in the ordinary way. Still relational, you still have a graph. The average distance between two nodes is large, or very large, for a very large number of vertices at very low temperature, this can be huge. You can think of it as a low-dimensional system if you want to interpret, for example, this cube as a piece of three-dimensional space. I don't need that for what I'm doing in this work, but if you did that, then you would call this low-dimensional. The fact that this has subsystems, that is subgraphs, means that you now have two options of external and internal time. You still have the external time that tells you whether this is going to keep changing into even different graphs if you keep lowering the temperature, but you also have notions of internal time, which is the ones that subsystems, looking at other subsystems, may use. So here, just by the fact that you have a notion of locality, you can go into an internal description of the system. And I'll discuss this very briefly in my conclusions. This can actually be an important thing here. And finally, what you have here is macromatter, that is the effective U1 excitations, and you can also have other fermionic excitations here by putting different labels, and dynamical geometry in the sense that I discussed, which is that the values of the micromatter on the system determine how the geometry of the ground state reacts to the matter. To summarize, what the price was for this was a model with four couplings and three parameters. My parameters are the number of vertices, the preferred loop length, and the ground state vertex degree. Some of these have generic conditions. So, for example, I'm looking at this particular regime here, where my number of vertices is huge, the coupling of the first term that turns Licks on is large, and the other ones compete with each other, as I discussed. And some have to be adjusted. So, what can you get from that? So this is the part where I want to tell you that not only are there ways to understand things like translations emerging from such a process and having a notion of a phase transition where you go from what I will call what was there before space to space, but if you take this phase transition seriously, and it actually happened in our past, so there was an early universe which maybe looked like this, and now it doesn't. Well, can you see that? So I want to argue now that not only you may actually be seeing that, it's also not a Planck scale correction. So here's an obvious place where you can look for the remnant of the high temperature phase. So consider the horizon problem in cosmology. So what you do is that you make a map of the sky and you realize that it's highly homogeneous. So you have correlations all over the sky. So if you know, what do you do in standard Big Bang cosmology? You consider the evolution of your universe from the Big Bang to the time of recombination, time of last scattering, when you are able to see any photons too, before that you couldn't see, to now. And what happens is that if you extrapolate your light cone to the time, the surface of last scattering, and you compare that to how long the universe had to get from the Big Bang to the time of last scattering, you'll find that the distance that you can cover with your past light cone is much bigger than how long the universe had to expand. So the two do not match, which will mean that there is, in principle, no causal explanation for correlations between the temperature at this part of the sky and this part of the sky. So I don't emphasize what you're doing here, and that is what's important to me, is you end up with this problem because you're extrapolating all causal and local structure all the way to the initial time. So inflation solves this. What it does is that it adds a period where the expansion stretched out so that this line here is not really correct, it really stretches out. So it gives you a causal mechanism for correlations to be found. But we also have a causal mechanism for correlations to be found. So if I consider now the evolution of my universe in either time or inverse temperature, then what I can plot, for example, is the average distance between two nodes. So I pick two nodes in my graph, and I plot how the distance between them, graph distance, on average will change as I lower the temperature or as I proceed in time. So what you'll see is that in the beginning, it was one, and it moves off one very slowly. Because when you have a huge number of nodes, even if you start removing edges, it doesn't make much of a difference. Still, everybody's roughly one step away. Then it starts increasing. If you look at the other find here, then again, it doesn't move very much, because once you are in a place, again, for a large number of vertices, where the average distance between two nodes is large, then adding one does not change it very much. It's basically the same you had before. And in between, there's some transition, which we don't fully understand, but there are some signs that this is a very fast exponential transition. For example, if you look at the degree of a vertex, that is how many edges come out of a vertex on by simplifying a Hamiltonian as a function of time, it drops off extremely fast. But anyhow, what do you have? Well, really, this diagram just tells you that your causal extrapolation to the beginning would really be incorrect. What happened is, if you wanted to extrapolate your causal structure to the past, you should not do this, which in effect is what leads to the original horizon problem. In fact, it dips very fast. Or another simple way to say that is, in the beginning everybody was connected to everybody else, therefore they have every chance to thermalize. So then what would you say? Well, look, my model may be wrong, but if it is not wrong, then it indicates that the CMB correlations may be a consequence of pre-geometry, or, if you like, of the fact that locality was not a property of the early universe. What I want to emphasize here, because I want you to consider this possibility that locality was not there, or is not a feature of the quantum gravity theory. And what you want to consider is the fact that this is very different than the usual phenomenology we have been considering. For example, if you make a discretization of our space-time where the discreteness is of the order of Planck length, it's very hard to detect. There have been ideas, and Sabine will discuss some things about what Planck scale effects might lead to. But having an actual phase transition from something that looked nothing like space to something that does have notions of locality and extension could actually have really large-scale effects. So this for me is one of the reasons that it's worth discussing such models, as well as the fact that this is not an abstract model, it's actually a concrete model. You can understand this phase transition, and you can proceed. So as I said, this is only a few months old. We are trying to understand how much further you can go. Can you do things like understand the perturbations in this system? And there doesn't seem to be any reason, since it's a very simple, straightforward system, not to do so. Nonetheless, the predictions are really novel because such a thing has not really been considered previously. Now, some comments. So a common thread I know that should be in the mind of a lot of people here is, well, how should I think of the time and the temperature? So I have a true Hamiltonian, I have a time. For background independent people, things like a Hamiltonian is bad, time is bad, the world should be given by a constraint. Also, if I have a temperature, I'm thinking of going into a ground state, you may want to ask the question of what law is the temperature? Do I have a fridge? Is there a bath to the system? Also, another thing that you might want to ask is, I've been discussing mostly emergent space. Again, if you come from a gravity background, then should I not be discussing emergent space-time? So I have some comments, about these questions. So for example, this issue of what is the importance of time. So I understand that you don't want to end up with a naive time such as a preferred frame, which has pretty strict experimental constraints. But having said that, there's a number of possibilities out there. So for example, I'm interested in the possibility where I have an underlying theory with a time, which has an effective description of a diffeomorphism invariant theory without a time. So for example, in this paper, we discussed the situation where you start with a theory with a time and it has a sector which is given by a constrained evolution. Now, this, though, the way that we did that meant that there is a bath, which also arises here in this question of the temperature. So do I need to have more than the matter degrees of freedom I just discussed? So this is currently an open question. I do not know whether the temperature I'm using and the time is some parameter, or that is an auxiliary object that then eventually can throw out, or whether it means that there is more to my world than my complete graph. By the way, I don't have much of a problem if there is more to the world, since the world that we know is only 5% of what's out there, and the other 95% we don't know. So I don't have a huge reaction to there being more than U1 degrees of freedom and some geometry to the world. But there's also another interesting direction, which Olaf Dreyer will discuss later, not in the context of my model, just more later, of this afternoon, of the difference between internal versus external time and the geometry you get in that case. So this is something I'm only mentioning here. Again, this time and the temperature refer to the God view perspective of my complete graph and its evolution in time. I could have also an internal one of subsystems observing subsystems. And that will presumably be a different description. And so I encourage you to go to the afternoon talk to hear some arguments on the relationship between shifting from an external time description to an internal time and the role of the Einstein equations in that context. So another thing that I want to emphasize here is the role of the matter in my system. Again, that sometimes gets missed, although I think I did make a decent effort to emphasize it already, which is that the terms in my evolution that give rise to the matter are also responsible for the geometry of the lattice. Just erasing the edges will not give you lattices with nice properties. In order to get some regularity, some order properties in the lattice, you need what also gives you matter. So in that sense, I'm using unification in a way that has not been done before, in that I'm using it to actually get nice properties of geometry out. Some short list of things to do. It's actually a very long list of things to do, but here are some of them. One is to understand the ground state. So a lot of the discussion that I've been giving you so far works by considering certain approximations when you consider, for example, which couplings are more important at which regime. So in order to understand properly what the properties of the ground state is, we do need substantially more work. What I want, again, to note here is that I actually like models very much. I like, in principle, being able to solve a model and see what it does. And for me, there are some interesting lessons here, which may be also interesting for you, which is that if you look at a Hamiltonian, it has several terms, but it's nothing as complicated as a spin-form Hamiltonian or a spin-form dynamics. It is a much simpler system. Nonetheless, it is a really difficult system to understand. When I share that to somebody that does condensed matter physics, they go like, good luck, try. So it is actually, in order to use a model to get some predictions, I'm just reiterating some of the things that Balogh was saying before, you do have to keep some decent balance between how non-trivial the properties of your model are and whether you can actually get to an answer. And this one seems to have that, although it is still pretty non-trivial to understand the ground state. What we are doing to do so is both a thermodynamical analysis of the system, as well as mapping certain terms of our Hamiltonian to graph theory analysis. So in graph theory, people also consider things like, well, it's usually a different way, so we remove edges. In graph theory, you consider situations where you add a lot of edges. But you can, as far as we can tell, you can use, you can map your system to graph theoretic systems and get some results, which we're getting. You can, and we are, keep understanding what the effects of non-locality are in some specific context. For example, the cosmology I was discussing before, and analyzing perturbations of the system. You can also discuss effective disordered locality description. This would be like this, that you say that you're in the ground state. So here the ground state could be the black graph. And you want to see what the world would look like if you go a little bit backwards in time or if you increase the temperature a little bit. And one way that you could model this is by adding non-local links to your local ground state. So we had considered with Lee Smolin such a setup before, but we did not have a good way to determine what the distribution of the non-local links would be as you increase the temperature or you go backwards in time. But here you could do this. So, for example, if I'm going to give the distribution as a probability of two vertices of the ground state lattice to be connected by a non-local link, I can now get the probability distribution from the Hamiltonian I have. So I can have precise, effective locality description of the system and see what the effect of that was. So we already had some suggestions on possible effects of this distribution, but we didn't have a way to get the P, the probability, from some first principles. So now we do. And as I said before, one wants to understand the role of the temperature and the time in the system. And I'll finish here. Thank you.
I have two marginal comments. The first one is, the models by the Lebesgue when are essentially lattice gauge theory on a fixed lattice, where each plaquette has the mean of a unit of error, basic unit of error. So you take one of these models, modify them to some extent, and then put them on a dynamic lattice. So could I think in that sense of your model as kind of a quantum value with a fluctuating metric or error metric in the sense because the number of plaquettes is dynamic? That's my question. Is it kind of a fluctuating error metric? And the second point is you said that you do everything with space and then Hamiltonian. That's a good nice setup instead of space-time picture. Wouldn't it be, since this is already lattice gauge theory on a fixed lattice, could we just also put a lattice gauge theory on a fixed on a space-time lattice and let that become an angle?
Okay, so I think the first one first. That's an interesting suggestion. Maybe? How about we think about it? I mean, I imagine that at some point you reach a regime where it doesn't make sense anymore, right? So at a very high temperature, I'm not so sure that I would call that area. I think it's a mess. But possibly when you're somewhere not far from here, what you're saying is correct. So that's interesting. So I'd like to think about that. The second one, Yeah, that might also be a possible way. I haven't thought about it. We kind of tried to use as much of Levin and Wen as we could, rather than redo it. But depending, that's, I guess, part of trying to understand what the role of time is, that it might be interesting to do that. So thanks for both.
I have a question about this universal definition. Do I understand it correctly that you're trying to solve the horizon problem by allowing particle interactions to be in regions that were usually causing disconnected?
Kind of, so, but I'm not so sure what you mean by particle interactions, because I wouldn't think of them as particle interactions. I'm trying to solve it by saying that there was a mistake in the setup, which is that the way that you end up with the horizon problem is by extrapolating our causal structure all the way to the beginning, that if I extrapolate in my model, I hit the phase transition before I get to the beginning. And so the extrapolation that you normally do just doesn't hold. Is that all right? Okay.
At the beginning, you seem to have a very symmetric theory, symmetric with respect to all the permutations of the vertices. So what breaks this
symmetry? Well, I turn off edges, right? So let's see, you might be asking two things here. One is, what gives the extension? And the other is that you might guess that if I just turn the off edges, then I should also end up with something that is large but permutation symmetric. Is that what you mean?
But you turn off edges also in a way symmetric way, it doesn't distinguish.
Well, okay, so I think, I've actually wondered about this, but I think that so if I take a system and I allow it to cool, and the original system has symmetries, it does not mean that it will be preserved. It depends on how the cooling happens. So possibly you could do something. I'm not exactly sure, so I have not actually done it, but I've wondered about this, whether you could maintain the permutation symmetry through the cooling to the ground state, but then presumably you would have to have a very controlled cooling, slow, something like this. If you just have usual systems won't do that, something will happen before something else.
I was confused about what you said. There's more background information in the causal set thing.
Did I say that?
You had a list of approaches that you said, I want to be more background independent.
I was not ordering background independence, but alright, so I guess, so I don't know that I said quite this. If I want to say something, I would say that normally the, depends what you think that one thinks about the causal sets, right? If I'm thinking of the elements of the causal set as relating to some discretization of a space-time geometry, then this is, in some sense, less geometric, if you want, because there isn't any geometric aspects to my original vertices. They acquire so after the phase transition. But I guess if you have if a causal set is just some partial order with no meaning to what the vertices of that are, then it's not really that different. But the thing is that if you do that, then I do not really know why you need to consider a superposition of these. Because I think the superposition comes from considering some quantization of the space-time geometry. If the elements of the causal set are nothing that comes from space-time geometry, then you have to tell me why you consider a superposition of them.
Do you think that this
Well, so I would probably say that it doesn't, and in that sense, that is the way, so I didn't mention that, but for example, if I was to compare this system with, say, dynamical triangulations, that is also a statistical system when you try to see regular geometries in a certain regime, But the main difference between that and that is, in dynamical triangulations, is that there is nothing for the Einstein equations to start with. So I guess in that sense, I'm subscribing to the emergence thought, and then I would say there may be ways for the Einstein equations to emerge. And that's where I was pointing you to Olaf Dreyer's talk. So there are some ideas, but I think that's what I would go for.
Okay, so I think we should finish this.